Welcome to this edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us on this Monday here in the city as you listen to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. Exciting things to talk about on the show today. First, we're going to talk about The Wizard of Oz. The Kansas City Ballet is doing that. And then in the second part of the show, the Kansas City Actors Theater premiere of Dracula, A Song of Love and Death. So we're going to go from Oz to Dracula in the course of the program today. I know you'll enjoy yourself. I already know that I am. Thank you for tuning in. The Wizard of Oz opens on Friday, October 12th at the Kauffman Center. With us from the ballet to tell us about it, Devin Carney. He is the artistic director. As you've surmised from past interviews, Devin hails from the musical city of New Orleans. What a great place to grow up, entertainment-wise, I'll bet it was. Yeah. Has also had stops in Boston, Cincinnati, but has worked all over the world. And he finds himself now in Kansas City, where he is, how many years now?
I'm working on my sixth season now.
Yeah.
Your
sixth season? Yeah. Well, glad to have you here once again. He brought along with him Septime Weber. Septime is the artistic director of the Hong Kong Ballet and the choreographer of The Wizard of Oz. He has worked with the Washington Ballet, the American Repertory Ballet Companies, worked throughout North America, Colorado, Canada, Cincinnati, served on various boards. And he is with us to tell us about such a well-known story, but this is kind of a reinvention, as I understand it. I mean, new costumes, new choreography, probably new music as well.
Sure.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
And Devin showed me some sketches earlier. The costumes look really impressive. So a little bit of a different version on that. I read that you get some of your inspiration from the original books. You went back to the Frank Baum books, and they were a series of books, and we think of it as just one long story, but that's not the way it actually was written.
Sure. This production is a kind of sum of different parts and influenced by certainly the original Frank Baum book, but other iterations of Oz. As a kid, I grew up in the Bahamas until I was 12, and we didn't have television. My seven brothers and one sister and I had the beach and sandcastles and books. And that Frank Baum series, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, and then several, six other books, were really central to our reading time, but also fantasizing, putting on plays on the beach, etc. So those were always around. Somewhere mid-childhood on a trip to Miami, I saw the movie for the first time, and I saw it on a black and white TV, so I didn't even see the color version. And I was gobsmacked, if that's the word. But it would just bowled me over. So those were really, really important. And throughout, then I moved to the States when I was 12. And throughout those sort of middle school year and high school years, I produced a number of kind of amateur versions of it in puppet shows here and plays. And in the late 70s, the Michael Jackson, Diana Ross film, The Wiz, came out, and I saw it, and I was mesmerized. And what it did for me was it took this period piece that I knew from the book and from the film and fast-forwarded it square into, I was a 16-year-old interested in pop culture at the time. Mm-hmm. And suddenly Oz was new, and Oz was of my time, not an older generation. So it was always, so all these sources have been swilling around in my head. And then there's a fourth source, which is just my own imagination. And just kind of, I think whenever you tackle a great work of art and want to adapt it, whether it's, a new film adapting Romeo and Juliet or any kind of work of art that tackles a reinterpretation of an original source material, when the source material is considered a work of genius, there's no reason to do it unless you can bring something particular to that work. The new work of art has to exist as a complete holistic thing, with a point of view and something original to it that illuminates a facet of the source material that wasn't readily understood by audiences.
You have the advantage that there are young people that probably have not seen the movie before.
Yeah. Sure.
And they're in one of Mervyn LeRoy's books, he explained the color, not color. He wanted Kansas to be very drab. He wanted Oz to be very colorful and sure. exciting. And he did that purposely.
Sure. But Kansas in real life is anything but drab.
Oh, well, they thank you for saying that, of course. Yeah. But you had a different inspiration then for that. And that probably leads to the way you write or teach the steps that you take.
Well, I mean, the process is a collaborative one. I knew the source materials. I wrote the libretto. After we agreed to do this project, I spent, the libretto came pretty quickly. Reading the book about three times in a row, watching both of the films that I knew well again, the original 1936 film and then The Wiz. I actually, interestingly, have never seen Wicked. And I sort of steered clear of it during this process. I just didn't want new influences. So I wrote the libretto, which essentially mapped out how the ballet would be constructed and what characters would exist. And then about a year before I actually began to work on steps with the dancers of Kansas City Ballet, I worked intensely with the composer Matthew Pierce to write the score in its entirety, and with Liz Van Dahl, the costume designer, to design the costumes. And so before choreographing steps for characters like the Scarecrow and the Tin Man or the Munchkins or the Winkies, I already knew what they might look like and what they might sound like. So there was already a kind of DNA built for each of the characters before actual the steps arrive. So that's kind of a fun process, and that meant that's a collaboration between me and those other artists that work together to envision what each of those characters might be like and what they might reference and how they might be enough like what audiences expect, but different enough to surprise them. I mean, at the end of the day, one of the goals is to, a lot of people buy tickets and come to the show because they love the movie or they love the book. And we operate in a kind of benevolent bait and switch model where we're seeking to tell the story, but in a surprising way, a way that they did not expect. Right. There's enough there to fulfill expectations, but only just so. Everything else we want to be a complete surprise and finish the storytelling in a manner that the audience did not expect.
Yeah, well, that's a good way to do it with all the reboots that are being done today.
Sure.
How could anyone expect anything else?
Sure.
They will expect it to be the basics probably, but still different.
Sure.
Still different. Devin takes such great challenges. I mean, there's new costumes, new music, new choreography. You showed me some sketches of the costumes earlier. In a way, that kind of changes the personality of the character. So don't expect to see it played the same way, that they played it back in 1939.
Sure.
It was just entirely different.
It was God's in the details. So the fun part for us is the details of how each of the characters operated. I'll give you an example. When we first started to develop the Lion King, what the lion would look like and would sound like. Initially, the sketches that Liz Van Dahl, the costume designer, did looked like he was an escapee from the musical Cats, with like a kind of a mullet wig. It's like Liz, we got to lose the mullet, we got to lose the leg warmers. Let's think of what the inspiration might be. And we went back, actually I had a very interesting conversation with the composer and the costume designer, the three of us, about the lion, thinking, all right, he's this cocky character whose cockiness underscores a kind of cowardice. And we came up with, but he's also kind of flashy. He's like the flashiest of the three. It was like, and we came up with this idea of a kind of Jim Morrison meets David Bowie look. So the lion has gold chains. He's like a gold chain wearing hippie rock star with the fur bell bottoms, essentially, and gold rings. And he's got a kind of cockiness. And then when he's slapped, he melts into like being a child. So the bravado that's there is really artifice. Just like all those gold chains, the artifice of a rock star would be artificial. Then, in talking what the music might be like, I sent Matthew, who is a classical composer with a romantic bent and writing for a 60-piece string orchestra, I sent him this really hilarious and surprising obscure recording of Sly and the Family Stone singing Que Sera, Sera. and it has this organ, and it's just brilliant. It sounds sad, and it sounded like what a sad person might indulge in listening to, you know, in the late 60s, like some sad classic music. And it was so good. It was like the Sunday morning crying record that this rock star, when he was sad or hungover, might play on a Sunday morning. Kind of thing. So that was a kind of a complete package of vision of what that character might look like and sound like. That allowed me then, literally a year later, to be choreographing movements for the lion that would react to that. We did a similar thing with the Yellow Brick Road. We were trying to figure out how to realize the energy of the road. You know, the tickets from people sitting in the orchestra can't see the floor very well, the stage floor very well. It's not very present. Then we're going to have a yellow floor that doesn't really make sense. And I was thinking about the energy of a journey. The journey, when we go on a road trip and there's an energetic road and there's tips and turns and you don't quite know where you're going. And as a metaphor, we decided to use eight men as Yellow Brick Roadies, Roadies accompany a rock band. These wild yellow brick costumes, they're like yellow bricks, really. Like it's like piles of bricks in human form. And they have this wild energy. They're jumping off of this yellow ramp and making wild shapes. Rather, they jump in very geometric shapes. I've tried to make geometric shapes the way bricks might be geometric, like a Lego person almost. Mm. And they're metaphorical for the energy one has, adventure and danger in a road. And they accompany. It was also helpful from a kind of craftsman standpoint. There's a whole passage where it's just Alice and Tin Man, Scarecrow, and Lion. Their presence helps break up the solos into small group sections, which is kind of fun. And they've got this like powerhouse energy, allowing the characters to be more sensitive in relation to the group.
We're speaking with Septime Weber and Devin Carney, both artistic directors. Devin of the Kansas City Ballet, Septime currently of the artistic director of the Hong Kong Ballet. And we are talking about the Kansas City Ballet's new version of The Wizard of Oz, a world premiere, new costumes, music, all of that. The costumes looked fabulous from what you showed me. It kind of, in some ways, it changes the image perhaps, but I guess down underneath, the characters are still basically the same people.
Oh yeah, for sure. They are. They're fabulous. I think that's one thing that Septime mentioned earlier about bringing some new facet to the characters, which I really believe through his choreography and Liz Van Dahl's, the costume designer's costumes, that they have a larger personality now than I had seen before or imagined could be before, which is so unique about this production, that Septime has gone beyond our expectations, which I think is really wonderful to have that opportunity to be enlightened in a way you never thought you could be with a story that is so well known.
I think the reason classics are classics is that they embody something important that we can all relate to.
Yeah.
And in the case of Oz, my goal is for the audience to relate to Dorothy. Whether you're a man or a woman, a boy or a girl, Dorothy's that person. In fact, Dorothy's costume, for example, is the only symmetrical costume in the whole show. Everything else is on the bias and wildly asymmetrical. She's the centered one. She is us. She is the person. She's the mirror.
Yeah, she's from Kansas. The others are from Oz.
Yeah, there you go. And she's gorgeous too, by the way. Yeah. She's younger, more beautiful, thinner, can jump higher, and can turn more than we can. But she is we. You know, she is the collective we. And that story she tells is really her journey meeting. So I think we can relate to Dorothy. That's number one. Number two, we can connect to all of those other crazy characters, maybe because we know someone like all of them. We're not meant to necessarily relate exactly to the lion, but the lion's like our older brother who was a mess up in college, was in a rock band, and then made good. You know what I mean? The Tin Man is that really sensitive kid in high school that we had to protect from the bullies. You know, those, I think throughout it, we can relate to all of those those characters in a way that's charming.
Oh, we can relate to them. I remember seeing that original movie. I could relate to them. Of course, I was quite young, and it scared the wits out of me.
Sure.
And that was because of the witch. What have you done with the witch's characters?
We've tried to retain a scariness about her. And she's very chic. She's a sexy witch, actually. child-appropriate sexiness.
Uh-huh, sure.
But she's you know, very, very powerful. Her strength, she has two big scenes, one in Munchkinland and one in the Witch's Castle. She appears intermittently to threaten, but her big scenes are those two scenes. And I've created two fiendishly difficult solos for her. And the technique, the pure technical prowess, serves as a metaphor for her power. You know, she can turn like a top, and that's without assistance of anyone, and that's a metaphor for what a powerful woman she is. Sure. So we kind of get it that way.
You must have been planning this, Devin, for a long time. It sounds like, with all the details. Well, at what point did you nail down Septime?
I was going to say that farthest thing you've described.
How do you keep away from a stand?
I would say you probably planned for a couple of years.
It's almost 2 years ago that Septime approached us at Kansas City Ballet about his idea of creating a Wizard of Oz, and as soon as I caught wind of this, it took me very little time to actually think about it, because I had always thought, gee, wouldn't Kansas City Ballet be the perfect place, the perfect company to be doing a ballet about the Wizard of Oz, which is, of course, based in Kansas.
Well, sure.
So it's been spectacular since the very first beginning conversation. Septime had all these crazy, wild ideas right from the get-go, and he had this really exciting other part of his idea, and that was that it would be a collaboration between three companies, that we three companies, that being Royal Winnipeg Ballet in Canada, Colorado Ballet in Denver, and Kansas City Ballet here, that the three of us would equally share in the costs of producing the ballet. So we'd get this wonderful large production for a third of the cost, basically, which is awesome. The fact that Septime was so excited about the work, it was clear that this was a project we needed to jump into head first and go for it, which, I'm seriously grateful for that we have been pursuing it, and it's been such a great process watching Septime's ideas come to light. And again, through his incredible design team that he's pulled together, you've got world-class designers in every respect involved in this process. And what's exciting, here we are, we're about to open this show, and to see all of this incredible imagination from all these world-class people coming to light now, to life here in Kansas City, is just, I'm so thrilled. I can't wait for opening night. It's going to be spectacular.
You guys are so lucky. You have a vision of things. You work a lot, I guess, in your own mind, in your imagination, as it were. And you get to see it come all to life. Most people in their lives don't get to see things quite that adventurous.
I think we are aware we have a really great job. Yeah. We have a fun job to have.
I think you do, for too. Sure. You get to put something on and see it come to life.
Sure.
And you can change it around if you want. We can't change our lives around, but in the entertainment business, you can.
One of the cool things about this production is that I'm very excited to see the, as Septime calls it, the shelf life that this ballet will have, because it's going to be performed by three companies right away, the three collaborators. And then beyond that, it's destined to have quite a life being performed all over the world by many, many different companies. Just like, for instance, his Alice in Wonderland, which we performed in 2014.
Will you travel with it?
Sure. It takes a village to put together a ballet like this. It's a huge ballet. I think there's, I heard yesterday, like 240 shoes have to be dyed for each show. Yeah. And 140 costumes or something like that. So the model is, there's been a whole team of repetitors, of ballet masters, who've been assisting me in the rehearsal process, and they will go from company to company. The ballet master here will go to Colorado to teach it. The Winnipeg ballet master will come to Hong Kong once we do it, which I'd like to happen in next year. So there'll be a team. Like many choreographers, I'm very effective in making up the steps. Others are better to teach the steps because I can't resist changing the steps when I teach it. So it's just more efficient to have me not in the room when it's taught. And then I'll come in and put the finishing touches and coach and adopt. I mean, when you have a lot of different dancers tackling any given role, I don't believe in cookie cutter. My goal is not for the Colorado Ballet Denver production in February to look exactly like the Kansas City Ballet production. The structure will be all there, but I do go about adapting steps for the talents of the particular dancer. You know, we have two witches performing here. They're very, very different. One is like a powerhouse virtuoso. The other one has about the longest legs and arms that I've ever seen, and much more an exotic kind of dancer. So I've made some changes in the choreography between the two of them to maximize their special gifts. It's great to be both of those two things. And so now there are two versions of the witch material, one for the long, leggy, exotic, Bambi-like character dancer, and the other for the pistol pack and mama. So it's kind of fun to have some nuanced differences between casts.
And along the way, in different cities, I mean, you've cast, and I guess the cast will travel for the most part. No?
No.
You're going to recast and retrain in different places?
Yeah, in the ballet world, unlike the theater world, casts are assembled for each particular show.
Okay.
In the ballet world, ballet companies exist as a unit. So, you know, Devon and Kansas City Ballet have a group of dancers here. All of them stay, you know, are one-year contracts, but most of them spend whole swaths of their career in the same company, or maybe their whole career in the same company. So they're resident companies, so a completely different group of dancers will perform in Colorado, and then a completely different group in Winnipeg, and a completely different group in any other city where the ballet might be done.
Now, sometimes you have special events connected with the show. Some of them have probably passed by now. See, this is the 8th. So do you have any events coming up before you open on the Friday the 12th this week? Any special events coming up?
No, we're by that point, we're going to be heading straight into the theater. We're quite busy 24/7 from today, which is Monday, right on into the opening on Friday.
But you're very good usually for at having.
Oh, yeah. We've had a bunch of different exciting events. We did a lovely event at Union Station a couple weeks ago, which drew quite a wonderful crowd, where we gave a little sampling of some of Septime's work and some of the costumes. And the mayor was there and proclaimed the day for Wizard of Oz. It was quite a fun event. So we've been having things like that.
Yeah, you've really made it hard on yourself. You're going right from this into the Nutcracker, which is another big production.
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, we don't want to stop.
Oh, no, of course.
Never do that.
Never take a break, I suppose. Yeah, the show opens this Friday, the 12th, at 7:30 p.m. Performances continue Saturday, the 13th, at 7:30. Sunday, the 14th, a matinee at 2. Wednesday, the 17th, at 7:30. Thursday, the 18th, at 7:30. Friday, the 19th, at 7:30. Two performances, really taxing your dancers now. Two performances on Saturday, the 20th, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and Saturday, the 20th, at 7:30. And Sunday, the 21st, a matinee to close it out at 2 o'clock p.m. The Kansas City Ballet performing The Wizard of Oz. The number to call for more information, 816-931-8993, or online at kcballet.org. You can make your arrangements online as well, and call and do the same thing as well. A lot of information is on your website. You can show people basically where they might be sitting. They have an idea of what the view is going to be like. You made a comment earlier I thought was very interesting. You say when you're actually closer, you don't necessarily see the stage the same way.
Sure. A lot of people like to see ballet from the balcony. I like to see it actually from the orchestra. I like to be relatively close, I like to see decisions that dancers make about how to tie their point shoes and how they apply their makeup, etc. So I like the real details. So there's lots of different tastes. But from any seat, I think it's going to be a pretty adventuresome ride.
I'll bet. It's kind of like a dream team of designers and costumers and
actually,
all
that. One part of the dream team that's been really fun is the puppet designer. Nicholas Nahon has made some amazing puppets, particularly for Toto and the Winged Monkeys. I won't talk much about them, but I think the audience is in for a nice big aha moment.
Oh, I can remember as a kid watching the movie being fascinated by those monkeys. How did they get them to do that? But of course,
they really fly. Yeah. They really fly. Actually, we've been having flying lessons.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Sounds wonderful.
Jetpacks. We have jetpacks.
Sounds
individual jetpacks.
Sounds like it's going to be very entertaining. I'll bet the audience is surprised and pleased.
I hope so.
By all that's going on, all the effort that all of you have put into it. It's going to be, of course, at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. The number to call, once again, 816-931-8993. Or on the web at kcballet.org. You have this one. They have the Nutcracker coming after this. Then the rest of the season, I wish we had more time to talk about the rest of your season, but it's going to be great as well.
Yes, absolutely. We've got quite a lineup. Again, just go to kcballet.org to find out all information about our entire season.
And it all kicks off this Friday, the 12th. At 7:30 p.m. I want to thank you both for coming. Definitely. Telling us all about the fabulous Land of Oz. You know, just above Kansas, somewhere. Somewhere above Kansas. Devin Carney, as always, the artistic director of the Kansas City Ballet, and Septime Weber, artistic director of the Hong Kong Ballet, the choreographer of The Wizard of Oz, a lot of ballet companies all over the world. Thank you so much for coming in and telling us about The Wizard of Oz opening this Friday at the Kauffman Center with the Kansas City Ballet. We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, this is really going to bite. Actors Theater, Dracula, A Song of Love and Death, also a brand new script. You'll be interested to hear about that when we return. You're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM. And welcome back to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Boy, we're gonna have some fun with this one. At least I am, anyway. Kansas City Actors Theater, in connection with UMKC, they're doing a collaboration together. And collaboration's becoming more frequent now. And I think that's a good thing. It helps one theater or the other, and sometimes both, especially in the case of UMKC. But they're collaborating on Dracula, A Song of Love and Death, which will be running from October the 12th. On through
The 21st
at the Spencer Theater on the campus of UMKC, here with us to tell us all about Dracula. Always a fun subject to talk about. Josh LeBrun is with us. He plays the role of Dracula. And John Rensenhaus is here. John Rensenhaus, we've seen for years around town here. He's directing this. When I think of John, I think of Shakespeare because of his many appearances doing Shakespeare at the Shakespeare Festival. But John has worked all over the country. He has been on television, things of that nature. And we welcome him back.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here, Michael. You sound a little bit like you're getting tired of me.
Not at all. It's always a pleasure to talk.
It's always a pleasure.
But you were on, what was your soap opera? The Edge of Night.
The Edge of Night.
People might recognize him from that as well. Stage presentations all over the country. Every year you seem to work back east somewhere.
I do. I work around the country quite a bit at various theaters where I've, worked in my long and storied career.
And Actors Theater is lucky to have him now.
Oh.
They have some real professionals at Actors Theater.
Well, that's what we are. We are a collective of working theatrical professionals.
Yes. John is directing on this occasion, and Josh LeBrun is playing the role of Dracula. It's a new adaptation, and I've read that John was very excited about this new adaptation and all that would add to the story.
Well, I am very excited about it because we commissioned Mitch Bryan, who is a local writer, to do the adaptation after, there are many, many stage versions of this play. And the Kansas City Rep had done Dracula back in 1987. They did the traditional Balderson and Dean. And so I knew we didn't want to do that version. And I knew a couple other versions, and the UMKC, this is a co-production between Kansas City Actors Theater and UMKC, and we had sort of differing opinions about which version we wanted to use, and to compromise, we decided, well, let's get a new one. And Mitch happened to come to me at that time saying, I hear you're doing Dracula. Do you know which version you're doing? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, we don't. And he said, well, hey, could I write one for you? And so I said, well, your timing is perfect. Yes, you could.
He's mostly known for his film writing. Was this... It wasn't. It probably wasn't his first play, but
No. He's written some other. Mall of the Dead and Bucket of Blood that were done at the living room and Coterie. But he had many years ago written a Dracula miniseries that almost got picked up, but then it never got made. I don't know the exact story, but so he is a Dracula freak. He loves all things Dracula. So I figured, well, this is great. Let's have Kansas City Actors Theater for the first time commission a local writer to write what we're going to do. So well,
Josh is playing Dracula in this role. How does all of this affect you? It's a new adaptation. You, of course, have seen the films and probably the stage productions over the years. An actor has to find their own place here. How did you find yours?
Sure, yeah. Well, actually, I have seen bits and pieces, but I decided to try to hold off on watching any more Dracula films or previous stage productions because, I don't know, it's a brand new adaptation, so we wanted it to be a brand new Dracula. This is a different Dracula than you've seen before, I think.
There's a history of fine actors playing the role,
right,
some more campy than others. I point to the George Hamilton one, exceptionally campy. John wouldn't want you probably to do that.
But, no, I don't think so.
But you've seen many of them over the years. Well, where did you find your place in all of this? Well, do you have fun with it, but on your certain more serious level?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think there are some... I guess we talked about when an audience comes and sees Dracula, I mean, there are some things that they want to see. I mean, there are some... A couple of melodramatic moments, I think, that I have. And I don't know, but we wanted... I think the little blurb about the show really sums it up well. It describes it as sensuous, seductive, and sinister. And I don't know. I think that's the Dracula we were going for. Hopefully,
well, it is all about sex,
right? Exactly.
Whether people realize it or not.
I think there are frightening moments for me to hopefully be frightening, and for the audience to be frightened and maybe even a little bit disturbed by what they see, because it is a disturbing thing. Some of the things
there are sexy moments too.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and
seductive
there are some of
moments,
those.
Right.
Yeah.
I should ask the director. Well, what is this really all about, John?
Right. Yeah. Do tell. What is it all
well,
about?
Well, I've tried. Mitch and I, we've tried to focus on the book was written in the late 1890s, and for me, it really hits as an exploration of the awakening of the female sexuality, which moving out of the Victorian times into a looser sort of time, the awakening of the two female characters in the show, Lucy and Mina. So we've really focused on that.
Right, well, because this adaptation, one of the neat things about it, I think, is it's really more from their perspective, from the Lucy's and Mina's perspective. It's really their story, the story of the group of friends.
And it's not to say that through their, you know, more open sexuality, they're inviting something like a Dracula in there, but how that sort of works in the mix of all that confusing stuff as people come of age.
It's usually done as a period piece. Are you doing it that way as well?
Yes. It's set in the period, and then it's two things. I mean, it's not the campy version. It's a very serious, very bloody version.
Very bloody.
There's a subtitle, A Song of Love and Death. We've gotten a little bit of confusion that people are thinking it's a musical. It is not a musical. It is very definitely a straight play.
There are certain things that Dracula has to do in the show that would involve working with blood. And you work with blood as well.
There will be many moments when I have to work with blood.
Yes, we have big plans with blood.
Is that fun, Josh?
Of course, absolutely. Of course, I mean, who doesn't want to work with fake blood, right? I mean, it's a joy.
Yes, we're required to make it washable because it's going to get on the costumes.
Right.
And it also has to be edible.
Now, why are these things so fun? They're so fun to watch a show like that. I mean, some people are so frightened they can't watch it, but and it is scary. But it's also very fun to watch. It's this fun kind of scary.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, it's titillating. Because it's okay. In the Spencer Theater in the Performing Arts Center at UMKC, which is a big theater, we won't be having a splatter zone. I know some people really look forward to these bloody shows and, I want to sit in the splatter zone. It's not that kind of show, but there will be a lot of blood.
What did you see in Josh that made you want him in the title?
Oh, please. He's tall, dark, and handsome with a nice, deep, seductive voice.
That was really
perfect.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. It's fun when you see other actors do it. It's fun to watch.
It's great. And we're working with the third-year class in the MFA training program at UMKC. There are seven students in that, and all of them are in this play. And it worked out very conveniently that Josh, we auditioned a lot of people, not from the school, from the whole community. But Josh was my choice, and it's great that he is a graduate of the UMKC training program there.
Yeah, what other things had you done at UMKC and beyond? I mean, I should have read more of your credits than
I did. No, that's fine.
You appeared at the Coterie, the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival, the Christmas Carol at the Rep, the Fringe Festival as well.
Yeah, that was the most recent thing I did right before Dracula Adulting, which was a sequel to the Rugrats. Rugrats Grown Up.
That got a lot of press.
Yeah, adulting. It did. And I think very deserving. I'm sure I did fine. But the play was extremely well written by Priska, and Jake did a fantastic job directing that. And it was just a great ensemble.
There are always challenges, of course. What is the challenge with Dracula?
I think the largest challenge for me is, Dracula is a larger than life character. He isn't human per se.
In the classical sense.
Yeah, right, exactly. But you can't play him as a two dimensional character either. I mean, it's tempting with these bigger characters to play them. I don't know, kind of flatly and less of a dynamic range, but they still have to. I mean, they still have wants and fears and desires. And
sure, well, we don't have time to go through the whole Dracula genre, but he was once human.
He was, yeah, he was once human, and
good point.
right, and so I think that's the biggest challenge to be larger than life, but also still.
I don't believe Stoker ever went to the beginning how all this started. Anne Rice did in her books, but that's a different universe, of course.
Yeah.
That she writes her stories in, but she dabbled in vampires, of course, as well as witches and other creatures as well.
Yes, I think there's been a renewed interest in vampires in the past few years.
How do they outfit you? You were talking about costumers earlier.
Yeah,
I just tried on
my costume this morning, actually. A lot of polyester so that we can wash the blood out. Yeah, no. Well, it is the Victorian, from the Victorian era, with a dash of steampunk, I think, for my costume.
And, of course, a cape.
And a long cape, yes.
The cape, I guess, is very important. It gives a kind of a dash of appeal.
Yeah, and we use the cape a lot, quite a bit, in the show.
Let's talk about some of your female co-stars. We'll go with the female co-stars first.
Sure.
The ladies that you... And seduce is the right word, I think.
Sure, yeah. Marion plays Mina, and Chelsea plays Lucy.
Yes, Marianne McKenzie.
Yes.
And Chelsea Kinzer.
Mm-hmm. And... So Renfield is traditionally a man.
Yes, I read that. You have cast it as a woman.
Yes, we cast it as a woman, and it's brought us some wonderful things that we didn't think the story held, but by switching the gender up, it's revealed some great things for us.
Is she as loyal to you as a male Renfield would be?
Oh, yes, I would say so.
Yes. Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Devoted to me.
Yes.
Devoted?
Very devoted. Uh-huh. And we've also added a character of a maid who works in the household. A lot of the versions will add a maid in there who also facilitates Dracula's, you know, entrance into the house and all this stuff. So we've got four women. And we also, Van Helsing is being played by Kip Niven, who's very famous Kansas City actor and beyond. I mean, he's worked nationally. And,
quite a bit. Kip has stories of Hollywood.
Oh, yes.
Just ask him.
He does.
You'll hear some interesting stories from there. Good cast. Do they all go in the direction you would like to see it go?
Well, we're getting there, Michael. Well, it's interesting because when Josh was talking about this being, you know, bigger than life, that Dracula is a bigger than life character, you know, the story is sort of bigger than life because it's a very archetypal story. And so I have been working with the students who, you know, default to a more naturalistic style of acting, to becoming bigger, to fill the story in the way that that we need to, and to fill that big space, the Spencer stage. It's a big space. So it's a big set with a lot of sound and projections and blood, and we've got to have our acting up to that level.
Yeah. Good technical people, good costuming people as well.
Yes, oh yes. The both those departments are great at UMKC, the technical program and the costume program.
So the division of labor is such that they take over the more, some of the acting roles, but also some of the more technical roles.
Yes, they're in charge of the technical aspect of the show, which is great, and we help to, you know, give the students guidance and experience in what a professional job would be like.
The show opens in previews, I believe, on October the 12th.
Yeah.
And then continues through
October 21st.
October 21st at the Spencer Theater on the campus of UMKC, the same place where you will see the rep productions when they're done on campus. The number to call for more information is 816-235-6222, or you can hop online and go to kcactors.org. We're speaking with John Mensenhouse, the director, and Joss LeBrun, who plays the role of Dracula in the show. I don't know, it just sounds like so much fun. Do you have to watch it? Watch yourself. You don't want to overact it, or is overacting encouraged by the director for this particular instance?
You may answer that, Josh.
Oh, I can. You know, I think erring more on the side of overacting is kind of safe to do in a role like this.
Some people say that about Shakespeare. Now, you've done the Shakespeare Festival.
I have, yeah.
Did you play any of your parts in that manner?
No, those were more, I don't know, John mentioned naturalistic, but those were more naturalistic, I guess you could say, because they have to be big. They're outdoors, they're in a park, but you don't want them to be.
See, one of the funniest things I've noticed at the Shakespeare Festival is people who have a copy of the play on their lap and actually are following the lines along. You don't have to worry about this doing Dracula.
Yeah.
But
Yes. The Shakespeare Festival is an interesting combination because it's, you know, it's outdoors, it's a big space, but you're also wearing a microphone, so it's also kind of intimate and a radio play. So you have to be big and real all at the same time. Your voice has to be sort of intimate and real, but your physical life has to be larger than life.
Are you able to have fun when you're doing Shakespeare?
Oh, yeah.
I joined this play, Josh. Obviously, the more fun you can have, I would think the more beneficial it would be to the character.
Yeah.
See, you're playing an iconic character.
Yes.
And there's a lot of pressure there. So no copying of any previous Draculas, and we can name a whole laundry list of
them. I hope not.
I guess it's hard to put your own particular mark on a role like that.
Sure, but, you know, I think John is quite helpful in I don't know, making sure that we have a unique show and a unique Dracula.
Right, and we want it to be fun. It's going to be fun, as you say.
It is.
People want to come see Dracula because it's fun to get scared.
It has all the potential that's there, and of course, it's going to be running, you know, right before the Halloween season as well.
Yeah,
that
right
only
on
adds to the fun. I guess that was probably by design. You put together
it worked
season.
Out nicely.
Yeah. All kinds of fun.
I'm sorry we can't play all the way through Halloween, but the theater, they need to get the theater ready for a Christmas Christmas Carol.
That's so, right. They'll be writing a Christmas Carol in not too long of a time after that.
Can you believe it?
To be underway. You know, you did it last year, the Christmas Carol. Okay. I don't remember John.
I did it last year for the very first time. Okay. I played Fezziwig.
Well, you'd be good in that role.
Yeah.
The only person that Scrooge seemed to like from his past was old Fezziwig, as he so abruptly put it. It opens in previews October 12th. When is the actual opening night?
The 17th.
The 17th. You're having a blood drive, how ironic, on October the 12th during the day from 3 to 7 p.m. Where will that be?
That will be in the Performing Arts Center on the lower level, and I think it's in room 119.
Yeah.
I've been told I think you can walk in. You can just walk in and donate blood. We love to. You can come give your blood and then come see the show all in one fell swoop. You can also set up an appointment at esavealifenow.org with the sponsor code Casey Actors Theater.
Yes, what better time to have a blood drive than right before the opening of Dracula.
And I guess it's important to note, if you do that, then you can see the show for free. You do not have to pay for a ticket.
Well, there you go.
And we may even give you a candy bar or something to help restore.
Oh, some refreshments.
Yeah, some refreshments. Oh, yes, sure. After you get blood, yes.
That's certainly, it sounds like it's really going to be a lot of fun for you.
There's
and the
also,
audience.
Screenland, I don't know the exact dates on this, but the Screenland is going to be doing a screening of various Dracula films in coordination with this production.
Is there going to be a talk to the writer, to Mitch Bryan?
Yes,
That will be
he will be there to host the movies and to talk a little bit about what he wanted to accomplish with this adaptation.
Did you communicate a lot with him during the process?
Yes, and we are even, we're soon to begin performances, and we are even still communicating about that and changing lines. As we get it on its feet, we're like, oh, okay, that worked good in theory, but it doesn't really work on its feet, so let's change this and let's change that.
Does that make it more difficult for you with the lines changing, or is that easy to adapt to?
I mean, it does make it a bit more difficult to have new lines up to the point that we're at now. But Mitch has been great about, I don't know, being willing to change a word here or a word there, and that makes all the difference. Having a writer who's so willing to change the lines.
Yeah, just a week ago, we gave Josh a whole new introductory scene.
They did.
He had learned the lines for the old one, and we weren't happy with the way it was playing, so we, Mitch, rewrote it.
For those of you, the Count comes from Europe.
Yes, Transylvania.
Transylvania.
Oh, yes.
And somehow gets to...
To England.
The play is largely set in Whitby, England. That's where he goes ashore. It's also some scenes are in London.
Yeah, the different movies pick it up at different points. But this being an original, I was wondering if he changed anything like that along the way. Did he?
No, none of the major facts like that. There are brides, as in the book.
Yes,
Dracula brides.
Terrifying.
Will this lead to Mitch writing sequels for the stage? There are many in the film.
Well,
versions.
Yeah, we hope so.
Yeah, and are you going to be on board for all of that?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure.
Dracula will not age, so you'll have to adapt that. Dracula will not.
I've got a few years left.
Yeah, I know. I've said this several times now, but it sounds like you're going to have so much fun. Do you have to... He's frowning like it's not really this fun.
No, not at all. No.
It sounds like you're going to have so much fun.
Absolutely.
But do you have to perhaps temper that? There are serious moments in the show as
yes.
Well.
Yes. There are serious moments, and there are... You know, there's actually a fair bit of humor in the show, too. We found some funny moments as well. But yeah, I mean, you have to have fun even in the serious moments.
Are you worried about being typecast after this? There's a strong sense of that, perhaps.
I hope not. I love playing character roles, so that's. I hope that I can do more of that.
Is there a role out there in the future that you would like to play?
There are many roles that I would like to play, but I can't think of one particular one off the top of my head. But
well, you don't have to. I just decided if you had one, I'd be curious.
Not off the top of my head.
I'm a curious sort.
Yeah, sure.
good luck to you. And
thank you.
All that you do. Does John have any plans for roles on down the line?
Oh, Michael. Well, I had wanted to play King Lear for many years, and I got to do that.
Uh-huh.
So now I want to be in a Shaw play. I want to play Captain Shotover.
Oh, okay.
In the Heartbreak House.
Sure.
Maybe we'll do that someday.
Yeah. Well, you'd be right for that. One of the, at least the last show I'm familiar with that you did, it was like two of you, basically. You and the young lady and a romance.
Right,
and all of
that. Skylight.
Skylight, yes.
That we just did, yes.
Yes, now that was a good part for you.
Yeah. Curiously, a part that I never thought I would be playing in the winter, I'm going to St. Louis, to the Repertory Theater of St. Louis, to do a play called Oslo that won the Tony Award, I think, 2 years ago. And in this play, I will be playing Shimon Peres.
Oh.
Really?
Prime Minister of Israel.
Yeah, so we won't mention what happens to him. But yeah, that would be a challenge.
Yeah, that's a role that is not in my wheelhouse, shall we say. So I will look forward to the challenge of that.
The show is called Dracula, A Song of Love and Death. It'll open on October the 12th in previews, the 17th for actual performances, and run through the 21st of October at the Spencer Theater for the Performing Arts on the campus of UMKC. It's a collaboration between Kansas City Actors Theater and the UMKC MFA program as well.
Yeah, the theater department of UMKC. We actually have some undergrads in the show as well. And working on the show.
Is that a challenge for them to work with professionals like yourself?
Oh, it's great experience for them. Yeah, it's good.
Oh, yeah. I have to get them in line.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier, only a few get selected every year for the MFA program, and you're in acting and directing as well?
Yes, it's technically an MFA in acting and directing. That's the degree that you receive at the end of your 3 years.
What kind of in 30 seconds, what kind of process was that like to go through? They watched you perform, probably many discussions with you?
Just very quickly, I attended a program called IRTA, which is a conference of many different graduate schools, and I attended it in Chicago. So I auditioned and talked to many different graduate schools, and I decided to go to UMKC because I really enjoyed speaking with the professors there. I talked with Carla and Ted and decided that was the program for me. So
thanks so much, both of you, for being with us. The Mitch Bryan adaptation of the Bram Stoker classic Dracula, A Song of Love and Death, opening on October the 12th in previews. It's running through the 21st. The number to call for more information, 816-235-6222, or online at kcactors.org. Thank you so much for being
Thank
with
you,
us.
Michael.
Thank you.
The Jazz Insider is next. He's going to be playing some great jazz. We'll have jazz from 1 to 3, the blues from 3 to 6 right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hogue. We'll see you next time.